you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Time. It is my pleasure to have Jay Dyer back on the show. Jay, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Tim. How are you?
Great. Thanks for coming back on the show. Now, of course, you are the host of Jay's Analysis, jaysanalysis.com. You're also the author of Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film. Mm-hmm. And, well, what you cover in that book, I think is relevant tonight, but what I wanted to talk about tonight... You've done a number of interviews and also some talks analyzing the career and works of Zbigniew Brzezinski, who passed away last spring. And I want to discuss his role in promoting technocracy, as well as technocracy's subsequent implementation through, you know, the government policies, government agencies, the corporations, NGOs, and, of course, entertainment, you know, like Hollywood or even the Disney mm-hmm. Corporation. And maybe we'll discuss a little bit the history of technocracy itself, why it was developed in the 1930s. But anyway, Zbigniew Brzezinski, you've done a few talks on him, his books, and let's talk about Brzezinski. What was he all about?
Well, he was, of course, as I mentioned, a refugee, I guess you could say, not in the sense of refugees flooding Europe, but refugee fleeing Europe. From the Soviet era, and his parents were reported at least to be of noble descent from Poland. And so Brzezinski leaving Poland under Soviet occupation, then going to Canada, I think is what kind of, well, most people agree that propelled his anti-Russian fervor. So Brzezinski was, I think, a natural. So Brzezinski was, of course, fleeing Soviet occupation, and he therefore made a great recruit into the brain trust of the Anglo-American establishment. And it was McGill University, which interestingly, I never heard anybody else make a connection to MKUltra. And I don't know that there's any direct work that Brzezinski did on MKUltra, but it's interesting that he was at one of those central schools for the MKUltra programs, McGill University. And it's there that he would, I think, be eyed by different people, a potential recruit for CFR type work. And so when he wrote the Between Two Ages, which is the book that kind of predicts a lot of where we'd go in the electronic age, the technocratic age. That was in 1970. It's really this that caught the eye of David Rockefeller, and that's what many books on Brzezinski will discuss, is that, you know, that's why he was fingered for this role. And David reportedly called Henry Kissinger and said, I've got somebody for this new role that we need to start. Or it was either Henry called David or David called Henry, one of the two. And they decided that Zbigniew would be perfect for the first chairman of the Trilateral Commission in 1973. So it was there that he began, I think, to really do the deep state work. I mean, I'm sure prior to that, and he does actually cite Samuel Huntington and people like that. So Brzezinski is in that school of Bernard Lewis and Samuel Huntington. That's people that he learned from and, of course, adopted the Heartland theory and studied Halford Mackinder and all that. And I won't rehearse that. I'm sure your audience is familiar with it. But so he takes that approach, certainly, to geopolitics. But what's unique about Brzezinski are three or four things. And interestingly, I had a pretty heated debate with Kevin Cole over this. But I think I'm pretty correct in stating that it's really Brzezinski that pioneers the electronic and smart application of these technologies of regime change. And so that's what's, I think, the big, well, actually, you could argue there are quite a few things in between two ages that are future oriented and presage a lot of what we're seeing nowadays. So, you know, everybody talks about the weather weapons stuff that's in the footnotes in certain sections of the book. But he also saw all kinds of things like online education, that people would be taking their classes online, that you could basically re-engineer society through the internet. So a lot of people will talk about technocracy and forget that the internet is what he's talking about when he's talking about technocracy. That's probably one of the biggest examples of technocracy that you could think of. So Brzezinski foresaw the important role that the internet would take in everyone's lives, you know, all the way back in 1970. And as I said, that's why I think David Rockefeller saw him as somebody who was very important and crucial for these deep state roles. And of course, we know that he was the national security advisor under Jimmy Carter. And it's in that role that he implemented these other kinds of technologies that I'm talking about related to the newer models of regime change. So instead of those older CIA models of, you know, assassinating Mossadegh or something like, or attempting to assassinate some leader, having a coup against Mossadegh, excuse me, you know, that model was replaced eventually from the 50s into the more soft power approach. Now, granted, soft power certainly goes back to the old imperial models of the ancient world. But what Brzezinski was so useful at was integrating these models into the usage of technology. And that's what he, I think you could safely say he's the pioneer of. And so back in the 70s, he talked about the need for an arc of crisis that would stretch, if I recall, from the Balkans, the Caucasus, to Middle East, to Southeast Asia even. Yeah, there's a great long article by Andrew Gavin Marshall at Global Research that does a really lengthy discussion of what appear to be examples of Brzezinski's arc of crises, you know, all the way from basically bombings all the way back into the 70s, you know, all the way up to the Mumbai bombings, the Bali bombings and so forth, London bombings, and how a lot of this really fits with this model that we're talking about from Brzezinski. And if one reads the excellent articles that Vanessa Bealey and Patrick Henningsen have done on smart power, soft power, and you understand Brzezinski's works, and you understand, you know, the examples of stuff like him co-creating with Hamid Ghul and Robert Gates, the Mujahideen or / Al-Qaeda freedom fighters in 1978-79, then you understand basically the whole model of what you see in the world today. So Brzezinski, I think, is the key, and he's a little, you could argue, even a little more relevant than Carol. He's a kind of Carol Quigley, but without all the fun. Because he's crazy. He's Carol Quigley meets Bertrand Russell with no nonsense, just straight to the point. Here's how we're going to get the technocracy. You know, and certainly towards the middle of Tragedy and Hope, Quigley has a couple really fat chapters that deal with, you know, the implementation of technocracy and the AI computers and the military-industrial complex and the managerial society that's coming. But Brzezinski, I think, is not just a, you know, Quigley, his history writer, archivist. He's an implementer. And that's the big key here, is that Brzezinski is a point man for not just writing about this, but also implementing these new technologies that will utilize the latest in tech to achieve destabilization, arc of crisis, regime change, et cetera, to really destabilize all of the post World War II Soviet, what it eventually functions to do is to destabilize the Soviet satellites. And so this, once the Soviet Empire collapses, that was largely, as I said, a result of this arc of crisis technology model that Brzezinski had really dreamt up. And that's why he was so useful to the oligarchs. And so in many ways, as I said, for Praxis, he's more relevant than even a Quigley, you could argue. Quigley will tell you more about the bankers and history. But Brzezinski's going to tell you more about, you know, how to understand what you see on CNN. You know, when you see the news talking about, you know, a coup here and a destabilization there. Once you really nail down Brzezinski, you can understand what you're watching. So that, I think, is what sums up Brzezinski. And, of course, there's other peripheral addendum material that we can talk about with Grand Chessboard and how it kind of predicts 9/11 in subtle ways. It predicts the Ukraine crisis, you know, back in 1997 when he wrote the book that we saw in 2014. So that's what you're looking at. You're looking at a major geopolitical thinker of the caliber of a player, you know, of the caliber of a Kissinger, you know, who's really putting into praxis the ideologies. So he's not just a brains. He's also, you know, he also flies over there in the famous CBS clip, you know, that land over there is yours. God is with you. You will take it back. You know, as he tells the freedom fighters in Afghanistan.
He's sort of Quigley. Carol Quigley without the Irish charm. Yes.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, that's better. Yeah.
But with
all the Bertrand Russell, you know, bare bones atheistic, pragmatic, just
there's no sentimentalism with him. Yeah. No. I discussed Brzezinski with recently and with Joe Atwell, and we were talking about how figures like Brzezinski and Henry Kissinger, they're both foreign, right? I mean, and they have these distinct accents that they never seem to be able to shed despite years of living in North America. And he seemed to think that those accents themselves were a function of their role in sort of intimidating and Americans, you know, with their PhDs and their their positions in academia, that they're the ones with the education, the knowledge, and the wisdom to sort of plan the world, or at least play their part in planning the world. And I always thought it was funny, both him and Kissinger, who were these two huge figures in the late 20th century strategizing for the Atlanticist powers, both of them had these Germanic accents, Prussian, almost Prussian, all these Polish, becomes air of the world where, you know, there's really ethnically there's not much difference, European, and how it, just example once again how America has been conquered by Europeans.
That's an interesting point. I never thought about that, kind of took it at face value, but they could have been menacing in their affectation.
It was overdone. It was like,
interesting.
So I thought that was interesting. Another thing is to what extent, I know he's a described as sort of a gopher or a lieutenant for the elite, but in and playing such a large role in devising strategy for the Atlanticist powers, for the elite powers that are really behind these nation states that are playthings for the globalist. I mean, if you enjoy as much influence as a Kissinger or a Brzezinski, just ask you this, to what extent can they manipulate things themselves? Because they're whispering into the ear of the emperor. And, of course, historically, we know that often those people, the gray eminence, the people whispering in the ears of those who make the decisions, might be able to manipulate things for their own agenda. An example of how, well, the Cold War might have been for the waged for the interests that were behind the Atlanticist powers, the Anglo-American Empire. At the same time, his Polish background probably played a big part in his Russophobia, and his was he pushing his own agenda here too? I mean,
yeah, I'm sure that does come into play, because as I understand, he was pretty successful in a monetary sense. Obviously, I don't know how wealthy Brzezinski was, but you know, he's got a fairly prominent daughter who has the TV show with mm-hmm. Joe Scarborough that Trump caused quite a ruckus with this week. If you saw that tweet talking about her facelift, that was humorous. But yeah, I would imagine that there is, as I mentioned, due to that, you know, fleeing Soviet occupation, as we're told, that there was personal motivation and vengeance involved, perhaps. But you know, all the better for the Atlanticists.
Yeah, yeah.
That really fits into the 20th century strategy that we've talked about from Quigley, which dealt with, you know, the two world wars basically being about the weakening of Russia and Germany. So, mm-hmm.
And so Poland was there to spark the Second World War, which
exactly,
was Act Two. Kind of lure Hitler into starting another general war in Europe. Although it became a general war when France and Britain declared war on Hitler over his invasion of Poland, which is grew mm-hmm. out of the
which is what they encouraged.
Yeah, the Polish corridor. They encouraged Polish intransigence and then did nothing and let Poland get crushed between Russia and Germany. So again, that's another example. Again, then this utilizing that Russian, that Polish nationalism that had been. Crushed for almost 200 years between, you know, Germany and Russia. And then it became a reason for sparking a world war in the mid-20th century, early 20th century.
What I found so interesting about his writings was a lot of stuff that you wouldn't expect in there. You wouldn't expect there to be... No, I mean, it's kind of been floating around conspiracy circles and sites for a long time, but I don't think that most people would think about weather warfare and electromagnetic frequency warfare as something realistic. Yet it's in the 1970 book by Brzezinski. Mm-hmm. So he was talking about this stuff a long time ago and all kinds of other things too. I mean, he even kind of starts out talking about, as I mentioned in my talk, the usefulness of cosmopolitan areas and how, this really breaks down people's attachment to the land, to agriculture, and that there's a big shift that happens in cultures when they go through the process of, you know, industrialization and then modernization and so forth, and that how that this impacts the social order. And you know, he sees that model as key to understanding basically what we've seen in history happen to certain regions or nations, right? Quote, first world nations that have gone through the process of moving from agricultural societies to industrial to modern / technological societies. He sees those as microcosm models for the whole of the world. And this is why they're globalists, is that they think that the same model is going to happen. And one of the cheap ways that you're going to do that is with the net. The net will make things global, and that will move everyone into this hive mind. And that's why he's a technocrat. That's the central role here of all of this. And the internet is the internet is technocracy. And I mention that not to be Luddite or to be overly negative or fear porn oriented, but I mean, we just have to understand that that's a fact. And that's what Brzezinski's talking about. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, because as you get removed from the soil, further removed mm-hmm. you are from nature, you get further removed from the laws that bind nature and you forget that those laws still bind you, and you're, well, that's how you get, you know, transgenderism and these things, right? Because you should debate it. You probably saw the movie Her, with
how
you notice the cold surroundings, the urban surroundings, the apartment, everything's cold.
Exactly.
You know.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. The aesthetic of the film really betrays the emptiness. And that's really the point of that film, is that, you know, he's surrounded by human beings who, you know, the kind of one-to-one connection and love that he's looking for, you know, is ironically the Amy Adams character, yeah, the girl that's sitting there next to him the whole time, and he's fixated on this stupid computer program. But yeah, that's a great example of, you know, what Brzezinski's predicting here and what he would like to see implemented. And when you, there's a lot of other interesting interviews that I came across too. John Adams dug up one from, I think, the 90s from the New York Times or something like that. But in that interview, it's a link with Brzezinski. He goes into things like consumerism and Americanism. And that's also very revealing, because there it's more modern, you know, it's 25 years after Between Two Ages. And he's saying, look, we're at the point now where America is basically the battering ram to break down all ideologies across the globe. And that's something I've been arguing for a long time. Mm-hmm. A lot of people take issue with that, and they have a very, you know, they feel that I'm being unpatriotic or being mean or something like that, when all I'm telling you is that Americanism can be used as a tool to destroy other countries and other traditions, not for something better, but for the purpose of the globalists. And Brzezinski says that. He explicitly says that in that interview. He says, now, obviously, he doesn't give a shit about America. He has no concern about, but he basically says it's a costume that can be worn to spread hope in the sense of, quote, American democracy, which he more or less says is just oligarchical rule. He knows that there's no such thing as actual democracy. And so it's, you know, he explodes the mythology that it's not true. It's the American patriotism is basically dead. It's been dead for a long time. And so to be, you know, mindlessly pro-American, as so many people are, and, you know, support the troops and all this kind of stuff, it's really just serving the oligarchical agenda. And Brzezinski is a prime oligarch to show that. You know, he has no qualms about just saying flat out. It's kind of like, I don't remember if it was you or somebody was doing a show, an interview, and they were talking about, I think it was Alan Watt was doing a discussion about Prince Philip, and that they don't really like to give him interviews often, because he just oftentimes he'll just state straight out what they want to do. Like, but of course I want to see 4 billion people dead, don't you? Don't you want to see everyone dead? Well, the humans are a cancer.
Yeah.
So they don't give him that interview because, he's a little too blunt. And in many ways, Brzezinski is pretty blunt too. He just flat out says that consumerism and Americanism are the means by which you can destroy religion. And that's really kind of a thesis of Between Two Ages, mm-hmm. is that the three things that are ideology's dead, religion's dead, nation state's dead, and Marxism now is dead. So all of those are, you know, kind of come and gone. They're ghosts of the past, and we can move into the technocratic age. So hence, Between Two Ages, that's the new transition period that we're going into, is what he's talking about.
Yeah, you talk about of course, the exportation of Americanism and consumerism, materialism abroad. But one thing, it does not result in the material abundance for the rest of the world. That's just the it relies on impoverishing the world through the economic hitman model, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, all these things that Brzezinski said were great in bringing about this globalization. But before that was successfully done, it was, of course, it had to be applied domestically here in the United States. And here in the United States, you had through wars and economic crises and then prosperity, the destruction of any ethnic consciousness or identity here, particularly among the white majority. In fact, the bland white majority is sort of a denatured, deracinated conglomeration of the former ethnic groups. We see little bits of it, little Italy here. There's St. Patrick's Day Parade, but even that's been corrupted. But the breakup, ironically, of these urban neighborhoods into suburbia through various social engineering schemes, whether it's the construction of the interstate highway system or the creation of of the 30-year mortgage, courtesy of the federal government and these things. And this, of course, this coincides with the post-war boom of the Second World War and this explosion in consumption. And this is where you see the breakdown of any ethnic or religious identity among various ethnic groups. They became white Americans, but the only thing they could really identify with each other would be their consumption habits, whether it's through music, Elvis Presley or the Beatles, or the hula hoop, jeans, the T-shirt, these things. And so once they lose any ethnic identity, they can easily be manipulated through consumerism, which is what he's talking about here. And this becomes the good life, of course. That's promoted through mass communication, through Time Life, through the Disney Corporation. Through sports is a big thing, because sports is now sort of a substitute for maybe tribal or regional patriotisms that might have existed. That's all part of the corporate monstrosity, because through sports you can promote all types of social and agendas, engineering schemes. We're seeing with the NFL and the NBA or transgenderism, these things. So I'm saying it had to be done here first. We had to be conquered here in the United States before it was exported.
So. Yeah, and Brzezinski was very, I think, conscious of that, because he wore the cloak of liberal many years, being in the Carter administration, then being in the Obama administration. But he also served on various Bush task forces. So there's another character that, transcends the phony left-right dialectic. You can see it pretty clearly. But Brzezinski definitely understood, with his liberal egalitarian face that he wore, you would get the impression that he believed in equalitarianism and so forth. And he would often speak, of Martin Luther King or these platitudes. But at the same time, you have the cold, calculated technocrat who was very explicit about depopulation, very explicit about carbon taxes and Agenda 21. So Brzezinski was obviously on board with all that. So we know from that his supposed humanitarian model or a cloak that he wore was baloney. That was part of the guise that you wear, to be part of the Democrat establishment. And the same goes for the Republican establishment as well. So, he's picked out by the Rockefellers, right? These are the GOP, right? The GOP are picking out the so-called Democrats to run these big steering committees. And hence Brzezinski's membership, in Bilderberg and various Bilderberg steering committees, and being even chosen for slicing up Serbia with Wesley Clark and Kissinger on the International Crisis Group, which I've talked about many times. So Brzezinski is not at all a patriot to any group. And so, he's definitely at that level of people who believe that they don't have any ethnic ties. They don't have anything that binds them to any communities. And in fact, Brzezinski, even in Between Two Ages, early on, discusses the possibility of different organizations that could be used for mobilizing globalism. And he discusses the Catholic Church because it's one of the few global organizations. So Brzezinski, again, sees these entities not as something real or as bearers of tradition, but just as tools to be moved on the grand chess pieces. So the Roman Catholic Church is, to Brzezinski, one, the queen piece, maybe, and then you have you know, Al-Qaeda is a pawn piece, you know, it's like the NGOs are a rook piece. That's how he views all this, and race and culture, all of that is just another chess piece, another tool for manipulation. It has nothing to do with any sort of metaphysical verities or universal truths. It's just simply about cold, hard pragmatism, and that's the essence of technocracy, is that it's pragmatic.
And one thing that's important to point out is when you talk about members of the International Crisis Group, these elder statesmen aren't interested in solving problems and stabilizing the world. They believe in stabilizing the world through destabilizing the world, sort of like burning the village in order to save it. They need the world. Yeah, I mean, it's...
He says if America didn't do what it did, we would have anarchy. Well, so in other words, America has to cause anarchy or else we'll fall into anarchy. Mm-hmm. But of course, he's saying, you know, that the American world order, the Pax Americana, he says, basically keeps the whole globe in check. And into chaos and mm-hmm. so forth, so on. But there's also, you know, other interesting aspects to Brzezinski that you might not expect, like his support for the John Mearsheimer book about AIPAC. Mm-hmm. So he, I think, both kind of like Soros. Excuse me. Hold on a second. Kind of like Soros, he would, you know, at times draw the ire of certain factions like the Israelis because, you know, Brzezinski doesn't care for nationalism. You know, he thinks that's dead and gone. So in his mind as a technocrat, you know, that I don't think he has any special care or concern for the Israeli state. So I think you could argue that maybe he represents that kind of UN type faction. You know, Brzezinski would be much more favorable towards a United Nations type of model for global government than he would necessarily the Warhawk Bush neocon approach. So he's maybe not necessarily 100%, you know, on board with the neocons, although Gould and Fitzgerald argue that he actually is just a straight up neocon.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. They you know, they have a lot more time put into this than I have, but regardless, you know, there can be, I guess, at times, as we've said, disagreements about different approaches. But it doesn't matter because the end goal is still the same. I think Brzezinski views America and Americanism as a cloak that can be shed once the world is ripe for a total technocratic globalism. And in fact, when Brzezinski critiqued Bush, that was his main critique, was that after 9/11, he didn't sufficiently use it for globalism. He used it for too much Americanism, too much patriotism.
Yeah,
not
that's
that it was real, but...
Yeah, but then that's his criticism, is that this inspired opposition.
Yes. Right.
Created opposition with China and Russia. And it was their crude methods by going about this, which messed up the plan, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
As opposed to soft power, which is you don't talk about going in and conquering, invading. You don't talk about human rights and, you know... responsibilities to protect and things like that, as opposed to, you know, going and invading a country and imposing a government with, you know, with hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops, these things. But now,
and that was partly that's his model. Right? I mean, he wants to use his model. You know, he's the father of that in terms of implementing the technology. I realize that again, empires have used soft power.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, but Brzezinski is the real mover and shaker in terms of utilizing technology and what would eventually be the, you know, the hashtag type stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
All of that being, all of it being collated together, I think you can really point to Brzezinski as a father. Now, there was other figures right after Brzezinski, Joseph, what's his name? That's the sort of the Harvard father of this approach to regime change. There's another guy who's kind of also credited with being the coining the term soft power.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph, I forget his name, but he's one of these Harvard International business type guys. But it doesn't matter. I mean, it's really, he's just coining a term that was already the model for doing this in between two ages, that lays out the strategy of using all the technologies.
And you've mentioned, of course, Gene Sharp, this harmless academic up there in Boston.
Nonviolent regime change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess this is the invoking democracy and human rights to go in and disrupt foreign governments, foreign cultures, and sort of incorporated it into the Atlanticist fold, I guess.
Yeah, I wish I could remember that. I think it's even called, you know, it's the Harvard model. It's mm-hmm. the Harvard model of Joseph. Somebody was one of the professors at Harvard, I think. But yeah, I mean, that they have this down to a science, and that's why they don't really like that, you know, that approach of, you know, it was Raytheon and Boeing and the guys who might want to just sell tanks and weapons.
Yeah.
You know, they would rather, you know, use their NGOs than the latest anti-ballistic missiles or something like that.
Well, because but that, you know, an invasion like that expends a lot of weaponry they have to replace. So there's always pressure to go in, you know, with the guns a-blazing. Because that... Right. That destroys a lot of things. You have to rebuild and replace.
And it was Brzezinski. I don't know if Brzezinski personally profited off of it, but I wouldn't be surprised. But it was Wesley Clark, and you've mentioned it, but it was Wesley Clark and others who had interest in the mineral mm-hmm. area of Serbia and certain mines there, and that was a big part of the proclamations of Slobodan Milosevic is this evil dictator and. You know, we got to get rid of him, and what do you know? There's all this these environmental problems that we got to solve, but all of that was just a cloak for basically these people divvying up that country. And I think some people have pointed to Madeleine Albright getting a chunk of that too, mm-hmm. or something.
She has a big piece. I think it's telecommunications with Madeleine Albright,
right?
And Wesley Clark, it's the mineral rights or something. And of course, the
Brzezinski was involved in that strategy.
Mm-hmm. And you have, of course, Camp Bondsteel, which is a huge military operation there, which, you know, huge contracts, not to mention I would have to, that's a NATO operation, I think.
Yes,
which exactly. Means that, and of course, there's a huge human traffic and drug trafficking stream going into Brussels. And wherever you find a military intelligence operations, you're going to find, you know, human trafficking and explosion of drug trafficking. This also was their chance to, I believe, in the 90s to then send in former Mujahideen, veterans of the Afghan war,
yep.
into the Caucasus region, Chechnya. You know, also there was a Chechen civil war that they yep. could stoke.
And there was a yeah. kind of hybrid Kosovo Liberation Army, and this was a hybridization of communism, communist Marxism, and jihadist philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And Daniel has a great chapter on that, and others too. Engdahl's written on it. A lot of people yeah. pointed out.
Sorry, you cut out. That was Daniel Karibko, I think you said.
Daniel Eslin has a.
Oh, Eslin. No, so isn't Karibko a book called Hybrid Wars?
Karibko talks about it.
Andrew Karibko
talks about yeah. it. Yeah. And everybody knows this was a total CIA thing. Now, mm-hmm. pretty obvious. And now that doesn't necessarily mean Slobodan Milosevic was a saint, but it's interesting that you know he did. Marshal a lot of support from Serbian Orthodox people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if there couldn't have also been religious motivations involved there as well. But again, I'm not an expert on Serbia, but anyway.
Well, I mean, the Congress voted. I mean, the U.S. government, through the U.S. Congress, systematically took Yugoslavia apart because it made mm-hmm. foreign aid dependent upon the constituent republics voting to leave. The authority of Belgrade, and so they were literally bribing the other republics to leave to break apart Yugoslavia
because of Soviet influence.
Yeah, this was 1991, 92, 93, yeah. 94. And so they were provoking this Balkan War.
Okay.
By promoting secession, and you know the in this case the federal government supports secession. I guess you could say.
yeah. Oh right. Yeah. And also, you know. funding Al-Qaeda in that region as well.
Yes. And this, again, this stoked, yeah.
This is where Putin, I guess, fought his first battles, we're told, the Chechen conflict.
And that's, I guess that roughly follow along the fault line that Brzezinski sought to create with the Arctic crisis. Yeah. Yeah. And,
yeah. So, you know, again, we're at a major player here, and I think Patrick made the argument that Brzezinski's probably the most important figure in terms of geopolitics of the last 50 years. That's probably true.
Mm-hmm. What's amazing to me is all the experts, or the at least the acknowledged experts in geopolitics, who are always advocates of constant destabilization, war, and, you know, and misery. You know, because it goes back to the whole, I guess the whole study of it goes back to geopolitics, goes back to Mackinder, which inherently involves all that.
And
it's not like,
and you know what this is similar to that you and I have talked about many times is the mafia. And the reason I say that is because if you go to Hot Springs, which I've taken two trips there, it's really neat. I mean, it's kind of kitschy and cheesy and run down, but this was kind of like Vegas before Vegas was Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
Right around the time that Hot Springs was hopping as a mob region, and it was kind of a safe place where the dons could meet. And they would go to the baths and stuff like that. But what's interesting is that there's all these neat facts about the mob and the connections that most people don't know about. So Al Capone actually spent a lot of time in Hot Springs. I know this because I did a tour, which there's a mob museum here, and they'll take you on this tour. There are underground tunnels that were built underneath Hot Springs for various vices to be run. And so the... this is just a little neat side story. Whenever the FBI or one of the feds or somebody was going to come bust, because of course all the local police were all bought off. So anytime a fed or somebody like that would come in, maybe try to bust somebody, the local telegraph or telephone operator worked for the mobsters, and she would do a signal, and the whichever place was going to get busted, all the guys would run down under most of the businesses, by the way, on the strip have secret passageways and they would run down underneath, and they would run, down the block to some other building through this, because there's a giant underground tunnel underneath the whole city. So this was how they were running vices, and all imaginable, anything you could imagine is what I'm trying to say. And like, Al Capone teamed up with none other than JFK Sr. to run the to run liquor during Prohibition. And the way they did it, this is really neat. Actually, there's, everybody knows about Arkansas because of the water. There's all these giant water aqueducts underneath the ground. And that's why the water is so good. And of course, the Clintons and Rockefellers, they all have a monopoly on all this stuff. Well, the water companies around here, the famous ones that would sell their bottled water, they were actually running moonshine through, dressed up as bottled water.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was all these, but I had no idea that that was actually who was running that. It was Al Capone and Joseph Kennedy Sr. That's who was running that out of Hot Springs. So there are all these neat facts if you take a mob tour here. And then, of course, other mob characters, like there was Madden, who was a mobster from England, who was running a lot of East Coast syndicate stuff, and actually the New York mobsters would come and get advice from this guy. But he just lived in this little normal house out here in the middle of nowhere in Arkansas. And he was running this giant criminal syndicate, hundreds of millions of dollars, and nobody knew this guy. It was just some British guy who, was very unassuming, living out in the country and playing golf all day. So it's literally like something out of the movies. And the reason I say all that is that when you kind of look at the picture of how things worked on the small scale, and when you look at how operations will be run, say, by the FBI to try to bust these people, and how clever the mobsters were in getting around stuff is what I'm trying to say, then you can kind of project big picture. Well, the Brzezinskis, these are like just the big mobsters is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
They're the guys who do it to countries.
Yeah, it's they suborn, you know, the same way these mobsters would suborn or bribe local officials to control, you know, the levers of power indirectly, so they could, you know, skate away from the law when necessary. The bigger gangster you are, you know, you apply that nationally, like a Meyer Lansky to the federal government, who had control of Al Capone could never control J. Edgar Hoover. Meyer Lansky could control J. Edgar Hoover because he had photos of him. And the same thing applies internationally. Joe Kennedy would parlay his wealth that he amassed through you know, smuggling into eventually going to gambling. I think he owned a casino out there too. In Las Vegas eventually, but also to buy his way into political power.
Yes, and so, now here's another interesting little tidbit. Do you know who shut down all the gambling in Hot Springs?
Was it Robert Kennedy?
It was the Rockefellers.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. So what time frame was that?
This was in the 60s and 70s.
Okay. So, was that Winthrop Rockefeller?
Yes.
That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, so he campaigned on this anti-vice platform to get rid of the gambling. Now, when he got rid of it in the 70s, he sent all these feds in and these FBI people. That's when Las Vegas really blossomed in the 70s to be kind of the new, I mean, I understand there was people going to Las Vegas before the 70s, but there was a big heyday for Las Vegas in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a big doubt that the Rockefellers were actually interested in stopping vices. because when you figure out the history of the Rockefellers, they are Arkansas people. And they are connected to Walmart, which is also headquartered in Arkansas.
And yeah, now, explain Walmart's meteoric rise.
That's how Sam Walton got his Chinese deals. It's from the Rockefeller.
So we're going back to the Trilaterals Commission again.
Exactly. Now, how does this tie to Brzezinski? Well, who spotted Brzezinski and, you know, recruited him? David Rockefeller.
Yeah, yeah. I like you, kid. You got spunk.
But now, see, most people wouldn't connect all that to mafia-type stuff, but actually, when you look at, you know, Winthrop Rockefeller coming to power, and they knew what they were doing. And because if you go back to Standard Oil and that, I mean, these are serious business people. They know that this is Bible Belt. They're going to campaign on that anti-vice Bible Belt ticket, right? And that's going to dupe everybody. But they don't care anything about. They're not interested.
It's bootleggers and Baptists. Yes. And of course, that's interesting because you go back to the early part of the 20th century, John D. Rockefeller, the senior, the first, is a big promoter of the temperance movement.
So that's what they were saying was. Now that he may have actually had a. You know, a temperance type view. I think they were said to be teetotalers. I don't think they really drank.
Yeah, but had to do with gasoline. I think at the time they didn't want to compete.
What I was going to say is that there's almost always ulterior motives. It's not because of. It's about business, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and so that was that. That's what really gave it its real push. Mm-hmm. At least to the point, it became this sort of this. Spasm of insanity where they, you know, they passed prohibition in 1920. Of course, that is an outgrowth of the Lever Act of World War I, where government assumes control of all food, because it has to control food unless the Kaiser comes over and rapes all our women. So that's a sort of ratchet effect where, again, you get a war crisis, which, the federal government depends. Sheds the Constitution, forget that. We got a war to fight, and that gives all these interests the excuse to go in and pass these laws, which benefit the corporations.
Yes, exactly.
Standard Oil, is a good example of one. So,
anytime you see interviews with mobsters, anytime you talk to people who claim to know mobsters and like that, they always make the statement that the government's the real mafia.
Yeah. Like the Whitey Bulger, right?
Do you say that? Exactly. When I did the mob tour at Hot Springs, that was one of the first things that they said was, You know who the real gangsters are? Everybody's like, oh, the Italians. Oh, no, no. The government. They're like, why? They said, well, because anytime anybody came, they said the only shootouts that ever happened in Hot Springs was between the feds and the gangsters. It was never gangster to gangster.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I was interested to listen to Catherine Austin Fitch talk about this, sort of this planning ahead. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Walmart and how, you know, the rise of Sam Walton. This coincides with the 1970s and Trilateral Commission, 1973. Brzezinski is the first head of it. And this opening to China, of course, a few years before with Nixon and Kissinger, that secret visit he makes in the early 70s. Nixon mm-hmm. opens up to China. And right. This coincides with the Rockefellers and the Trilateral Commission. You're thinking decades ahead. I mean, it's... but she was talking about how in the 1990s, airports are going through these upgrades and renovations that they're turning airports into shopping malls. And as a businesswoman, she was looking at it saying, how is this going to work? Because people don't go to airports to shop. They go to airports to go to some far off place. You know, take a flight, go somewhere, to either arrive or to leave. They're not there a long time. 9/11 happens.
Mm.
All the security theater.
Theater.
You're stuck at the airport for two, three hours. You're going to shop. It's like they knew it was going to happen.
Oh. Interesting. You know. And yeah, you... Even though Brzezinski's not a PNAC character,
mm-hmm.
You do have in Grand Chessboard hints and subtle references to, you know, a new Pearl Harbor, that kind mm-hmm. of talk. So many people have even said that, you know, even Grand Chessboard might suggest, you know, a coming 9/11. And certainly Brzezinski would have known about it, you know, if this was a planned false flag type thing, which I think it was, obviously. So I feel like he probably didn't know about it, and again, it's not just 9/11. You also have him laying out the plans for the Ukraine coup, mm-hmm. all the way in the 90s, and that's of course as we learned that when Soros and Victoria Nuland were first putting the billions into the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine was starting back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And so presumably presumably Brzezinski would have been involved in that too, because I mean, he's laying the very thing out in Grand Chessboard as to what needs to happen in Ukraine.
Which is funny because that goes in talking about the Ukraine and the role that, Hitler played, for the Atlanticists. Yes. He was sort of lured into war and also to force him to invade Russia and sort of invade Russia and let Russia absorb the punch, you know, and so they could defeat Germany and also weaken Russia at the same time. Well, here we have the United States government in the 21st century promoting Ukrainian nationalism.
Yeah, just like Hitler did. Right.
Just like Germans and Hitler did in World War One and the Second, because they promoted Ukrainian nationalism. Hitler did that at the same time. You know, the SS battalions, the Ukrainian SS battalions, and here's the U.S. government supporting these, you know, these Stefan Banderas, you know, worshiping neo-Nazis. Right. Yeah, because this is another example of going into an area and screwing up with the local politics and the culture and just creating an arena of constant battle. Because, you know, if you get into the ethnic politics of the Ukraine in the 1930s, you realize that, yes, many Ukrainians have legitimate grudges against, you know, what they perceived to be Russians, but really were Soviets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you do? Well, you join up with the SS. when the Germans invade, because now it's your chance to get at the Soviets, the Russians.
There's a great article by Leonid Savin on the history of Ukraine and Russia, and it being properly part of the Russian sphere of influence.
Yeah.
You know, he talks about the history of the language, which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And when you read even Quigley, he talks about how Hitler knew that was crucial to Russia,
mm-hmm.
because that region, the Ukraine region, Crimea region, that is there's a lot of wealth, a lot of resources there.
Yeah, a lot of black rich soil that isn't controlled yet. Yeah,
and so that's why it was very important to split that off from the Russian sphere of influence. So it has nothing to do with anybody's, perceived right wing philosophy or whatever they're duped into believing. Mm-hmm. It's all about what Washington and NATO want to do there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just finished an interview with Guido Preparata about Conjuring Hitler, his book,
mm-hmm.
about the Anglo-American agenda to create Hitler in mm-hmm. the 1920s and 30s, and how Hitler ultimately served the objective of the Anglo-American, the Nazis' powers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think there's any question.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, even the funding of it goes in, whether it's the Dawes plan, the Young plan, and the money starts pouring in as soon as Hitler becomes power, comes into power, so you get the German recovery and all the industrialization that's aided and abetted, not to mention the fact the setting up of the European chessboard just in a perfect way that would create this war, they were just set up to fail. And also the double dealing, which you talk about, he read a lot of Carol Quigley to write the book, mm-hmm. so a lot of what he writes about in the book is what you covered in your analysis of Tragedy and Hope, about the dual policy, about Edward VIII and all that scam and Alger Hiss and these things. That crazy thing, and how Hitler was tricked into thinking that there was an element within the British establishment that was more sympathetic towards the Nazis, when that was just a ruse to get him to go to war and concentrate and negotiate with the British Empire. And so, interesting book.
How do we tie it to Disney? Well, as I mentioned, there's a clear tie from Brzezinski. We can go directly from Brzezinski to Disney. How? Well, if you think about Between Two Ages, the whole book is about the model of what kind of New World Order Brzezinski sees coming.
Mm-hmm.
And what is a technocracy? Well, it's basically that older philosophy of, a kind of socialistic utopianism that foresaw technology being the salvation of humankind. You can connect this to the Fabian socialists and these characters. You can tie it to Russian cosmist thinkers and science fiction writers and futurists, Berdyaev and these kind of characters. And what you get is the inevitable predetermined juggernaut of technology leading man, to the stars and all this kind of propaganda mm-hmm. baloney. And it kind of died out, but then I think what happened is that the Huxleys and the families of the Royal Society types, I think they were instrumental in really reviving it. And that's the milieu that you get with Brzezinski, who I think you could tie very, very closely to something like Brave New World. That's really what Brzezinski's outlining, is a Brave New World type of approach. I mean, he may not mention everything like cloning, but I mean, he's basically saying the same thing. So how do we get to Disney? Well, what Brzezinski sees is a completely controlled managerial society. And that's what the green agenda, the UN, COP 22 or 2020, whatever it is, the plans have for reorganized communities, megalopolises, all of these kinds of things that you hear conspiracy theorists talk about. That is what Disney was implementing as part of the conditioning process known as Epcot. So Epcot Center is actually the community of tomorrow. That was its original inception idea. And the idea was that, well, the future's coming. It's all going to be this tech utopia. It's this, utopian futurism that we see in these different philosophers. And so we can project that cities will no longer be organized the way that city planning was done for, during, I guess, the periods of industrialism and capitalism. You're going to have a completely controlled, basically the AI super grid smart city model.
Mm-hmm.
This will be intimately tied into all of the green regulations. And so this is what Catherine Austin Fitz has talked about many times. Gentrification is a big part of this. This is 100% part of the, even though the individual entrepreneurs may not know that their gentrification is tied to Agenda 21, what it does is that it rezones areas. Now, you've talked about zoning areas and how that's been used to destroy ethnic communities and, you know, Catholic cultures and so forth. That was all zoning laws as models for what we're going to see in the future.
Yeah, and progressivism, democracy, integration, these things, yeah.
Yes. Now, what they're also doing that not many people have talked about, I think I heard Alan Watt talk about this, but I've looked it up, but it is true. They will try to buy off mayors in local communities.
Well, I think that's been done already just through Department of Homeland Security grants. What do you think that is? Right?
I mean, well, that's interesting. I wasn't thinking about that, but I was thinking in terms of UN rezoning and refurbishing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen that happen in local cities near where I live. I think I mentioned that one of the talks was I can go not very far from where I am, and there's a city that's not huge, maybe 60, 80,000 population. And the whole downtown was basically refurbished. They built this giant art center and so forth and so on. And it was all done because the UN basically declared this some kind of heritage zone or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some kind of program to buy mayors off. And Rosa Corey's book talks about this, which I read her book too. She talks about them trying to get local mayors involved in this stuff. So it's been going on for a long time, but
yeah, it's done. It's done. It appears local initiative. It's the something local initiative. Local city initiatives. And really, it's all centrally planned, but it's implemented through the town councils, mayors. Yes. Gender 21's been that way too. The president and also governors have signed executive orders implementing these things. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And
ICLEI, the international. International Commission of Local or International Something of Local Initiative. I think it's ICLEI is the acronym. I'm sorry.
This is also connected to these kind of secret planned communities that are going up that not many people know about. I have the opinion. I've tracked down some proof of this, but I kind of think Sandy Hook was one of these, where the UN was kind of trying to make these make it a planned community where there would be no guns in the future, basically.
I had a sibling who we just got together for the 4th of July in Ohio with some relatives, and he came down from New York area, and he drove through Sandy Hook out of curiosity on his way down to Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And he says it looks like a one of those fake Western towns.
Yeah,
a Potemkin Village type thing. So there's something not real about it. Yeah.
Yes. Now they're building these cities and fake communities, and then later populating them. Some of them have gone up around Nashville, and what happens is it looks really nice and everything looks really tidy. But what you figure out is that the homeowners associations in these places have all these very bizarre, extreme, weird rules.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I believe. I don't have documented proof of it, but I can just assume that this is part of that that big plan. So they're creating these kind of new Stepford Wife type communities, and you say that's crazy. Well, actually, if you look at Disney's connection to Celebration Florida, that's a whole city that Disney created, and it's actually the model for Stepford Wives type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with this?
Well, I'm familiar with the that CIA through Paul Helliwell and not Wisner. It was the other guy, you know, the guy, OSS guy.
Donovan
were key figures in allowing Disney to build Disney World in Florida. They created two fake towns to get around the environmental tax laws, local tax laws to enable them to buy land on the cheap.
So Disney, you're right. Disney is actually its own city state.
Yeah, and this is the CIA. Paul Helliwell, the guy who set up Nguyen Bank and all the drugs coming out of Indochina and also the Caribbean, working with Meyer Lansky, who set up Paradise and Resorts International. These got Mary Carter Paint Company, which became Resorts International, which now Donald Trump, but they set up these two false cities to enable Disney Corporation to buy the land on the cheap. These are all CIA guys helping SRI also consulted with Disneyland out in.
Yep, did know that, right?
Out in the West, the same year that MKUltra started, by the way.
Yes, SRI. Right now, there's another thing though that later on, after Disney was already there, they actually bought land and built a town. And I'm not kidding. This is where they filmed Truman Show. So when you watch Truman Show with Jim Carrey, which is about a fake town, everything is surveilled. It's literally filmed in Celebration, Florida, which is a literally Disney-created town. And I was reading reviews of people that had gone there, just kind of random internet reviews that didn't have anything to do with conspiracy theories. And I'm not kidding. You read the reviews, they're like, man, have you ever read Stepford Wives or watched that movie? That's what this town is like. So what I'm getting at is that Celebration, Florida is probably one of the early models of the planned community cities that the Agenda 21 model is putting into practice, just like, you know, Epcot is the community of the future.
Yeah. And you've mentioned the target cities as sort of this micro living. Yeah.
They're all connected.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, of course, they're all smart, like Disney World.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Disney World has for a long time, you know, the Pentagon was who installed the biometrics. That's extreme news. Siemens Corporation, which has been involved in all kinds of skullduggery, German corporation. They were who installed the technology at Epcot, and they often premiere a lot of new advanced tech there for tech shows. All kinds of examples of stuff like that. But but yeah, I'm convinced that the Disney has been a long time, you know, Pentagon operation for sure.
And this is all part of what you talked about, how the Illuminati affect full spectrum dominance. It's through education, entertainment, what's trafficked as news, it's perception management. And Disney itself is a huge example, is great. Well, Disney itself is as a corporation, is make, you know, megalithic corporation, which boasts creating the imagination for children. They create, not to mention the fact that they play a big role in sexualizing the youth.
You can also find numerous mainstream news stories of sex rings and sex trafficking from Disney employees.
And there's tunnels under the city, of course.
Right. Now, that everyone has whispered about that, but that's actually true. You can watch there's YouTube videos that actually invest their old Disney documentaries that talk about it. Now the story is that Walt was just kind of a weirdo, and he would just go from one end to the other and pop up, you know. He would pop up and check in on everybody, make sure. But I mean, who knows what was really going on? He seemed to be a very odd character. And he was, you know, Disney was involved in filming propaganda all the way back into World War II.
Oh, yeah, the Donald Duck, Henry Morgenthau, had him do a thing on taxes for the Treasury Department of the war, get people adjusted to withholding and paying your taxes without, you know, protesting because there's a war to fight. They did all the animation, I think, for the Why We Fight films and these things, yeah.
There's this mythology that Disney was Nazi and he hated Jews or whatever, but actually... B'nai B'rith gave Walt Disney Man of the Year Award
a long time. Yeah. So,
I'm not sure I believe that story, but I think that it was basically just high level, you know, Pentagon type work. And Disney, you know, reportedly had access to Laurel Canyon Studios as well, which, you know, we don't know exactly what all was being filmed there, but there is a lot of interesting Disney space age stuff back in the, you know, 60s and 70s. Disney was very instrumental in promoting the NASA stuff, and I don't think it's accidental that NASA and Disney are both in Florida very prominently, and a gigantic Air Force base. That's basically right. The whole, you know,
there's Space Mountain right in Disney.
Yes. Yeah. But there's a gigantic Air Force base. I drove past it when I was down there two summers ago. It's on the it's on the Atlantic side. It's near it's near NASA, but I forget what it is. I can't remember the name of all these bases, but maybe Cape Canaveral or something. But there's all kinds of just, you know, gigantic, you know, Pentagon military type stuff down there. And I don't think that's accidental. I think this is all, you know, as you pointed out there with the CIA helping to found Disney through these fake cities.
Well, that just kind of makes that connection between, you know, CIA, you know, the intelligence agencies and entertainment, movies and these things.
Well, it was Gregory Bateson that said that the key to controlling man is capturing his imagination, something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's a Gregory Bateson quote.
And again, the CIA is more interested in anthropology and culture and these things than all in, you know, cloak and dagger stuff, which is kind of a cover. For what they're really interested in, which is culture creation. But you get that with, you know, of course, John Adams has done a thing about, you know, the cooking shows. Of course, Tom Secker has done, you know, and Tom Secker have talked a lot about just Hollywood. And your book, Esoteric Hollywood, is a big section on the CIA's involvement in Hollywood. And that's overt. There's a more esoteric, I think. And that's the problem with a lot of these things, because if you're trying to understand how the world operates, you just can't be fixated on what's on the obvious, the exoteric. It's the esoteric. And what you have to sort of engage in some level of inference or because what is the actual effect of all these things? You're not going to find a memo that says CIA orders Disney to produce this film, you know, so we turn girls into whores. You know, it's not that direct, but nevertheless, it's happening, and we're kind of seeing this alchemical reverse alchemy going on throughout society. You just go walk into a shopping mall these days and look at the people.
I put a lot of time into researching this stuff, and you learn new things every day. For example, I just learned this last week. I had no idea. John C. Lilly of MK Ultra fame, Dr. Lilly, you know, known for the flipper stuff, you know, like giving LSD to the dolphins. I had no idea that John C. Lilly has a whole book called Programming and Metaprogramming, where he literally talks about dosing kids with LSD and that you can tap into their subconscious and literally give them a program script. I had never heard. Did you know he had that book that literally says that?
No. I'm not surprised by it, though.
How is this guy not in? He should be hauled in for child abuse, but then you think, well, Alfred Kinsey can do these same studies. So now,
and you get on the cover of Time magazine.
A good point. Now, do I know for certain that there's a sex kitten program? I don't know that for certain, but I know there's Alfred Kinsey research, and I know that there's a John C. Lilly book on dosing kids with LSD and how to program them. And if you put two and two together, I could see how there could be such a thing. So I wouldn't be surprised if it didn't go that deep. But yeah, I mean, there's, like you said, you kind of have to infer on a meta level the possibility of, you know, you could combine the kind of approach that Lilly takes with Kinsey or something like that, and you could easily see how, you know, the CIA probably did do some kind of study on how to create a good girl who turns into a whore through mind control. Yeah, who knows?
And then, this applied to entertainment, which we see played out almost universal with these Disney girls that come out of the Disney stables.
Yes, exactly.
Do you think it's all just a coincidence that's happening? Is this some sort of programming that's going on there?
And it really is to wreck the kids. That's what's so crazy about it.
Well, I mean, I've talked about it a couple of times, I think with you, with other guests, is that There are, you know, the U.S. Public Health Service working with the Russell Sage Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and U.S. Department of Health, and these things talked about how promoting the AIDS scare would be utilized to implement a sex ed program, a very graphic sex ed program that otherwise parents would oppose, but the AIDS scare enabled them to implement the program for the very purposes of changing the students' mores and attitudes and values towards sex, i.e. corrupting them, sexualizing the youth. So that's just through the education system. Now, obviously, through the entertainment system, it's going to be a little different. But these are the same people that run the entertainment system. They're going to implement it differently. And you can see it being implemented through Disney or through the or through music itself. I mean, that's
But it's this is a great point that John and Chris have made too, is that it, you know, it's not just TV, it's also theme parks and museums play a big role in indoctrination. And, you know, we don't tend to think of it that way. We tend to think of it like, oh, there's that natural history museum over there, and or you can, in your leisure time, go visit Disneyland over there. But actually, that you know, both of these will be teaching a unified approach. A great example, I remember going, when I went to go hear that Tarpley debate back in 2010 or 11 in D.C., and I'd never been to the Aerospace Museum.
Oh yeah, the favorite, everyone's favorite.
Yeah, and when you go in there, you walk in and you see that dinky Apollo stuff. And I'm not kidding. I've told the story many times, but most of the crowd was just sitting there like, I don't think that really went to the moon. Look at that thing. That thing looks dinky. That's what the crowd was saying. But you know, I guess that's the power of propaganda. Is that
yes.
So then when you go upstairs, there's this giant, I'm not kidding, it's a giant Lucifer cloven hoofed, if I remember, mural. And it says, I think it says Apollo. And it's like, you know, it's supposed to be like the god Apollo or something. And you walk in through this exhibit and it's all this space stuff. And so what I'm getting at is just that you can't come away from that without thinking, you know, as well as the rest of DC, you know, like Chris always points out, is that this is like one giant pedagogical tour that I'm on.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and the tourists that come there from the benighted Midwest, you know, I've seen this on TV.
You've come to the land of the gods with the giant apotheosized, you know, George Washington up there, and the giant Abraham Lincoln that you pointed out. What is he, like 50 feet?
Yeah.
These are the gods or something.
This is, he's in his Greek temple, and wow.
Yeah, you know. Exactly.
And then you think, if you're like a sensible republic, is this how you want to view your politicians? I mean, does any serious historian ever present Lincoln in that? Well, some do. You know, yes, some do. You know, right. Doris Kearns Goodwin and your typical court historians. But really, come on. I mean, it's an insult to everyone's intelligence. This isn't reality. So why would you want to take your kids to these museums and present this as a good understanding of history that really occurred, as opposed to the propaganda, you know, that we...
Oh, here's another interesting point I would mention, too, to connect LSD, that something I just learned. Back even in the 50s, a lot of Hollywood and Disney artists, they were all tripping out. They were all using acid because it was pretty new.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the Disney artists were doing it. And there's even that... co-production between Salvador Dali and Disney. Have you ever seen that cartoon?
I think I know what you're talking about.
It's not Fantasia. It's something else. I forget what it's called, but it's kind of an underground, has a cult following type thing because it's so weird, you know, given Salvador Dali's influence. And then, but if I recall, that was both Walt and Dali were, you know, probably tripping out doing that. Other Disney artists were using LSD, and a lot of the Hollywood. In fact, there was a story I saw that Cary Grant did acid like some outrageous number, like 1,000 times, something crazy. He was just constantly doing acid, and you think about that being 60s, right? The Beatles introduced that. You know, LSD. That's Tim Leary. Actually, there was a lot of Hollywood people doing it. Acid back in the 50s.
Yeah, it was because, there was George Hunter White, Operation Midnight Climax, and the safe houses out there at San Francisco. And it was the 60s. The mass doses started with the rock and roll phase and these Dionysian rock festivals.
Right.
At the mass crowd. And
Owsley
Stanley or something. Yeah.
Correct, right.
You know, But
the reason I mention that is just that's another connection that you can make between MK Ultra, because LSD was a product of MK Ultra.
Mm-hmm.
for the most part. And it might even be the case that it was being given to, because it was new, it was like a, you know, elite thing. Here's this new drug. Oh, the Huxleys have done this. You know, they've been talking about it over in England for a long time. Let's, you know, so there were the Jets that was doing it in the 50s. You know, whether by design or not, I'm not sure. Probably. It was probably Tavistock.
Yeah.
That had already kind of pioneered that.
And did you hear about that? Was that new Disney program where you go into Disney and they track everything you buy, where you go, and you have a bracelet that identifies you so the characters can know your kid's name?
Whoa. I have not, but that doesn't surprise me.
So Goofy comes, you know, is on a first name basis with your kid. And all this is, it goes back to, you know, this whole day of, you know, of Disney being the model for the controlled, you know, system. You know,
and the last time that I went was, I did it just to analyze the whole thing. And when you ride Epcot, if you don't recall, or if you haven't done it, you go through the phases of the history of man.
Yeah, they have the auto erotica things.
Well, it ends in the Matrix. The end of Epcot now is you entering into the Matrix.
Jeez, that's the future.
Yeah,
they have the dinosaurs and the monks working there, and
exactly. And then right before the Matrix is this little nerd tinkering in his garage. It's Bill Gates. And he's building the computer, and then the next phase is you entering the Matrix.
Man, so I mean, you write about Hollywood, and of course Hollywood's role in all this. Disney obviously is a big part of Hollywood now too, because of the movies they control. So, how many studios do they own now?
I'm not sure, but yeah, I mean, you know, they own Star Wars and Marvel. So
yeah, there you go, and of course the whole superhero beam, I think, is a huge part of this agenda.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, you can. I think ultimately, I think it's also demoralizing because it makes people think the only way you can make a difference is if you're a superhero. You know,
that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
You know, it's like, oh well, I can't do anything. I can't, like Wonder Woman, charge a German machine guns and fight them off with my bracelets. So, you know, I have to wait for a superhero to come by.
I think this whole superhero thing, that's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that, but I also think you could argue that you're seeing this, you know, in the last 10 years, this huge rise in cosplay, people adopting LARPing, live action role.
Yeah.
I've talked about that. John and Chris have talked about that. And what this is doing is really on a mass scale like we've never seen before. People are adopting the synthetic life that they live on the side.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think what's going to happen, as I said in a few interviews and shows, is that if you watch the new Westworld, Michael Crichton was actually predicting that in the future you would have entire parks would become like that. Like what you're talking about with Goofy coming up and knowing your kid,
mm-hmm.
It's even going to go beyond that. There's going to be, you know, who knows what. There's probably going to be AI bots and sex bots at parks that will be whatever you can think of.
Well, I mean, I think the sex angle is probably the convenience and sex is how they get you. Because,
well, they're going to combine it, though, with these kinds of live-action stories. Like, are you familiar with the old Westworld, you know?
With Yul Brynner.
Yeah.
And what's his name from Goodbye Columbus? Richard Benjamin.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy from, who's the other guy?
I can't remember.
But he was in Marcus Welby, MD, and he was also in Capricorn 1, by the way.
Oh, wow, yeah.
You know, James Brolin.
Okay.
Yeah, so yeah, that was one of my, when I was a kid, it was one of my favorite movies.
Oh wow, okay. Yeah, I think that's what we're literally going to see, stuff like that develop in the future. I mean, it's not just accidental that they're, that Disney's created these entire cities and planned communities. I think they're going to integrate the virtual worlds with our world,
mm-hmm.
and it's all going to be just for control. And I think people are going to sign on to this.
Well, they will, because it's so easy. I mean, think about pornography and its weaponization. It's used as a political weapon to enslave you because it incites the passions. And once you become a slave to your passions, you have masters as he has vices, as St. Augustine said.
Right.
And this was E. Michael Jones made this point in his book, Libido Dominandi, is that this is a form of political control. Because once you lose your passions, you lose your critical faculties, and you can no longer govern yourself, and you're a slave to your passions. And those who satisfy the passions or desires or appetites that can control you. Now, pornography itself wasn't really a factor until the development of modern photography, particularly film.
Yes. Yeah, however,
the Nickelodeon, by the way.
I would like to mention that neither Michael Hoffman or E. Michael Jones are very consistent in their... The fact that both Augustine and Aquinas believe that you should have whorehouses, that they should be sanctioned by the state.
As far as what, like a pressure valve?
Yep. But I didn't believe that when I first read that, but they did say that. So interesting.
But the problem with that is, okay. Again, think about it from the standpoint of the common guy around seeing the first Nickelodeon, and you could pop in a nickel and watch a girl undress continually in front of you. What a shock that is to your senses and to your attitude, your view about things. With pornography, the effect of pornography itself on society, what it's done. Now, if you raise a generation on pornography and a highly sexualized environment, entertainment, you're warping that person's development as a mature human being, particularly the males. But it counts for both male and female. Affects them differently, though. Now you have a highly sexualized culture. They're neck deep in pornography. They can never develop a normal relationship with the opposite sex, or have realistic expectations. They have this sort of this playboy, glossy, airbrush reality of sex. This isn't real. Nor do they have to go through the effort of having a relationship with a real female, which requires work.
No, I'm not disagreeing with their overall points.
Yeah. Imagine the world of highly sophisticated sex bots.
What I'm saying is that's going to... Yeah, and I was actually seeing some articles this week about there are already in... Supposedly, these may be fake stories. I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised. In Japan, there's already guys marrying their sex bot.
Yeah. But, I mean, just think if you could enter into a virtual reality and have before you a girl that looks like Raquel Welch in her prime, and she's always agreeing with you, and she's doing whatever she wants at any time. You don't have to, she never gets pregnant.
Well, they'll probably say, you can come live in Westworld, down here in Florida, if you sign on to be sterilized.
Long as it's a contract, right? And people will, obviously with the, you'll see that with the growth of vasectomies and also the use of the birth control pill.
Come live your cosplay dream in, cosplay world at Disney, where you can,
And of course, signing on to that, you're just getting on board the road to the death camps one way or another.
Yeah, just to ensure that you don't go into the future.
But you can, again, this is done through entertainment. This is done through the media, the movies, these things. People's perception of reality is through the movies. This is why Hollywood is so important. It's when your book Esoteric Hollywood is so important, because people's understanding of these things really is increasingly through this, not so much through the movies now. I think you said it. I was listening to your interview on Red Ice when you're talking about your book Esoteric Hollywood, talking about it's going to change, just like how the movies changed radio. It didn't get rid of it, it changed it, and TV changed the movies, and now the internet's changing virtual reality, gaming. This thing is changing the movies. How movies now look more like video games, but this this interactive thing is particularly interesting, because that's going to change the whole nature of entertainment, and even
absolutely
not to change nature of entertainment. It's the gamification of reality. What we're saying.
Yeah, this is all really, I think, going to be handed over to the technocrats and the Facebooks and the Googles, you know, they're going to have a much greater role in what's going to happen with entertainment. We're actually already seeing the inklings of that with not just Netflix and streaming sites, Amazon Prime, but actually with YouTube is beginning to try to adopt this model. This is part of the whole adpocalypse debacle of the last several months that everybody who's had a YouTube channel has experienced. And the prevailing theory is that what YouTube is doing is instituting, well, they're allowing all kinds of content that people are going to find objectionable so that people will call for call for the censorship. And then what that will do is allow YouTube to basically censor anything relevant or any alternative media, any of the you know, the organic media that everyone is actually drawn to on YouTube. Then the censorship is going to be the transition into YouTube becoming a streaming service, just like Netflix. That's what's going to happen. They're already starting it. So that's not going to be good for those of us, you know, with YouTube channels that make money off of it and stuff like that. But, you know, what did we expect? It's not like we expected the establishment to continue, you know, allowing truth channels to make, you know, a lot of money every month. They're not going to allow that.
Yeah, and they shut it down through the demonetizing you.
And through supposed censorship, because you're never told what terms they're flagging you for. You have no idea. You don't know if it's because you said, you know, you could quote a news article and your channel gets demonetized.
Yeah.
And eventually they'll take down the videos. They'll say that your video contains, you know, inappropriate content, which will be as a result of Google and YouTube allowing inappropriate content on purpose so that they could have the reason to censor people.
Yeah, and they'll use the copyright excuse and the intellectual property excuse. They've done this internationally. To break down national borders, right?
Yeah.
They've done that. Same with they've done with banking, you know. And Castanos and Fitz made a point a while back regarding regulation, how we all know that the regulations don't apply to the elite, but they're there to more or less to harvest, to tax, to bleed, and just to frustrate those at the mid-level. And again, that's one way to stifle competition. There's another way, again, that everything can be harvested and taken away eventually. The wealth, you can't just take it all at once. You take it away gradually. Common Core, again, this is part of the educational approach, is Common Core itself, just through the interview a while back regarding Common Core with Dr. Farrell.
Yeah, I heard it, yeah.
About this all part of data collection, all part of technocracy, because everything is all the information is being your electronic testing data service, electronic data testing data service has a direct tie to MKUltra through the Human Ecology Fund, and it was
exactly
started,
and that's, you know, how they would be able to profile and figure out, you know, who might be useful in certain things.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, we were talking about that in terms of Phoenix program,
yeah,
and finding psychopathic individuals,
and of course with just with the improvement in technology, data collection, data analysis, and storage, you know, all this becomes more effective. Phoenix program was a testing program for the Department of Homeland Security. It's a prototypical program. Mm-hmm. You know, you create a civil war, you know, an arena of fear, same thing they've done here in the United States with terrorism. Applied differently, of course, because Vietnam is different than North America. The situation is different. Castanos and Fitz in the forward to the Common Core book talks about Obamacare doing just, it's basically, it's a way of sucking out the money out of the medical system from local areas, because the medical staff, the people that the administrative element of medicine, the people that run the doctor's offices, mm-hmm. as medicine becomes more corporatized, you know,
yes.
As individual practices are shut down, doctors go to work for mega corporations. And Obamacare is a big part of that because it's becoming too onerous for individual doctors to run their own practice. So they go to work for megacorp, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. I did finally get around to getting that Nancy Banks book, you know, which deals with the relationship to to the history of medicine.
Diamonds, and, opium, yeah.
Yes.
And AIDS, opium, AIDS, yeah.
Yeah, and once you understand, and then, there we go. Once again, we're back to Arkansas. And let's not forget, by the way, Mena, Arkansas.
Yes.
And the selection of Bill.
Who some say is related to Winthrop, right?
Well, if you walk down the strip in Hot Springs, there's a very ridiculous looking cartoon, like a giant billboard that's a cartoon drawing of Bill Clinton welcoming you. But he looks really, I mean, it's a really badly drawn cartoon. It's kind of funny, but
it's like a political cartoon type Bill Clinton.
But isn't that telling for the you know, you have the big mobsters, you have the medium mobsters, and then you have the front men politicians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was earlier on we were talking about consumerism. And consumer is used to break down sort of culture, break down these firewalls that exist in other countries and also locally. I ran this quote here from the old All in the Family show.
Mm-hmm.
Archie Bunker is there commiserating with Edith about the Democrats. Mm-hmm. He's dealing with the Democrats because this is the late 70s and Jimmy Carter's in office. And of course, you know, Archie Bunker was the Republican, blue collar Republican, which is kind of funny because, you know, up until the 70s, blue collars were associated with Democrats, but that's kind of shows you what was going on in domestic politics at the time. The red light, the right left paradigm being shifted around by the cultural people of the 1960s. But anyway, he's talking to Edith. He goes, I don't know what's going on here. And this time it's during the supposed energy crisis. Of course, another crisis that was created, non-existent.
By Bilderberg, right.
By Bilderberg.
Oh, right.
So he says, you know, for years they've been telling us to buy stuff, you know, that use energy. You know, electric ovens, electric knives, stereos, not to mention the cars. He goes, and after all, the corporations make their billions, they change signals on us, you know. And after years of telling us we can't live without this stuff, that they tell us that we got to live without it.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? From consumerism and gluttony, basically, to austerity.
Yeah.
And austerity is that banker trick, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's that sort of the Club of Rome type thing, the
yes,
environmental exactly. thing, which is why that's another way they convince people to give up their sovereignty, to accept immiseration, to be impoverished, you know, to live in mega cities. And
be, yes.
You know.
You need a coffin box apartment.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's all trendy. It's very Tony because it's, you know, if you're 21 years old and you can live in a 400 square foot apartment,
you know. And eat ramen noodles, fake food.
Yeah. Yeah. And not think about the long term consequences because eating like that, you're not going to live past 50 anyway if you're lucky.
Right.
You know. So what's funny about, again, what's interesting about Brzezinski was he's at this high level. He's talking about geostrategy, but it all plays down. It all trickles down to media, the food we eat, the commercials we watch, the music we listen to.
Well, that's what's important about Brzezinski is that, you know, I still run into people who get very offended by the things I talk about, or they get mad, or they, you know, various reactions. That, I mean, most people don't. Most people are, to some degree, kind of on board with, you know, if something's wrong out there.
Mm-hmm.
But every now and then I still run into people who just can't deal with it. And sometimes actually, you know, intelligent people, it's not just goofballs, but the reason Brzezinski is so crucial is that he is, you know, one of the few figures that pretty much touches on everything.
Yeah.
You know, in some way, roughly, he talks about manipulation of religion, manipulation through technology, MKUltra type stuff. He'll talk about, you know, false flag stuff. I mean, he's not going to outright say false flag, but he's going to talk about utilizing means of destabilization. You know, mm-hmm. He really does in many ways encapsulate. He's really the wet dream of the conspiracy theorist. Mm-hmm. If you want the guy to go to as your proof, you can't find anyone better than Brzezinski. For a footnote.
Yeah, but here's a question for you though, and this is what I was talking to the Collins brothers about Brzezinski, because I interviewed him roughly at the same time that he passed away, so I want to get their thoughts on Brzezinski. And one of the things they mentioned was, they kind of agreed with E. Michael Jones's analysis. E. Michael Jones said that the Soviet Union lasted as long as pretty much the life of one man, 75 years. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of mortal. You know, as soon as the older generation passed away, it kind of faded away. And they said that Brzezinski himself, the passing of Brzezinski, might represent the same thing regarding the global elite. That certain what we're seeing now is a reflection of the worldview of the David Rockefellers, the Kissingers, the Brzezinskis. Their passing may represent a changing of the guard, a changing of and we might see some shift in policy, which is I took it as sort of a somewhat optimistic analysis of Brzezinski and the situation. That's an interesting observation. And second to that is, who's taking their place? I don't see anyone
in
the same sort of depth or intellectual acumen.
Right. I think that came up when I was talking to Patrick about Brzezinski. And I think that it passes to the tech gurus, the Elon Musks, the Peter Thiels, the Schmitz at Google, I think the Regina Dugans. Of DARPA and Google, that's what I think Bilderberg has signified the last few years was the focus on tech.
Mm-hmm.
So that's who I think is going to take the reins. Now, I would guess that means that they probably think that they can go ahead and transition into, you know, AI running things, giant smart cities.
Sort of automated tyranny, sort of?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
The CEO of IBM, you know, she gives those lectures talking about that. So I think that's where they're going to pass the reins to. Whether that will be successful, I guess, really depends on, you know, what man chooses to do. But unfortunately, it looks like we're going into that. I think there is a reason to be optimistic, though, because I think people are going to they're going to have reaction to this. They're going to start realizing that a lot of this isn't for their good. The utopia that it promises, it doesn't deliver. Just like Sovietism promised this kind of, you know, cosmism and utopia, it doesn't deliver it.
Yeah.
So in that regard, I think there's hope. And also I think that if you believe in some sort of theological position, or if you have a worldview like that, then you believe that man is more than just a plastic entity to be crafted through some sort of mechanized Darwinism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that from H.G. Wells on, these characters have kind of had that view of plasticity of man, that you can mold man to be whatever you want, which is to say that he doesn't have a soul or a psyche or an individual identity beyond biology and brain matter. But I think humans are made in the image of God. So I don't think that we have to despair and, you know, think that the technocrats will win, because technocracy ultimately is empty. It doesn't offer anything beyond, some sort of immediate, an immediate form of making life easier. That's really all technology can do
is
make things easier. And just making things easier doesn't actually provide man with any kind of meaning or transcendent connection. And I think that humans are always going to desire, you know, metaphysics and a transcendent connection.
Yeah. Cause obviously we observe through physical exertion, we are healthier. So at some level, easier becomes actually a detriment to your
that's
health.
A good point. Exactly. You
know? And we all know that hard work creates character. So we all, there's a point where obviously you don't want to, you know, make a fetish out of hard labor. And there's a point, you know, but people, there is a sense of accomplishment we get, whether it's, you know, through exercise and getting results through exercise, maintaining your health through that way. Same thing applies to the spiritual. And there's a connection between the body and the spirit.
And no matter how many AI bots you bring to power, I mean, you're always going to have you can build a bot to work on a bot, but who's going to work on that bot? I mean, you're always going to need, I don't know that they're ever going to achieve this kind of whatever utopia they have in mind.
And there's no exhilaration feeling asking a bot out on the first date and her it saying yes.
I don't think so. I think even if this happens, humans are eventually going to kind of be bored with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not going to be able to offer, you know, what it promises.
So,
but anyway, I think that's all I've got tonight.
Yeah, well, that's good. Okay, yeah. So that's Zbigniew Brzezinski, Technocracy, and the slave grid that they're all trying to impose upon us. I want to thank you, Jay, for spending the time to talk with me.
Thank you, Tim.
And I'll let you, it's Jay's Analysis, jaysanalysis.com. He's the author of Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film. Go to his website. You can support his work by subscribing, $4.95 a month, $60 a year. Support his research. Check out all his articles.
And the book is still selling, so people can still order copies of the book and get one, give to your friends and family.
And are you still signing copies?
I am, absolutely. Okay, in fact, I still mail them every week, and I think I have almost 90 five-star reviews now.
Great, so. Excellent. Yeah, it is a great book. And to understanding what we're talking about tonight, reading Esoteric Hollywood is a must, because the entertainment, the films, the movies, these things, the creation of reality or the perception of reality is key to keeping anyone, you know, keeping control of this, you know, making everyone, I guess, submit or acquiesce to these things. So,
okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for your great podcast, and I learned a lot from your show.
Thank you. I'll bid you a farewell for now, and we'll talk again soon in the near future.
All right, thanks. Have a good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.